Hello and welcome to Onward, Fundrise Podcast. I'm Cardiff Garcia. I'm here with Fundrise CEO, Ben Miller. Ben, how are you, man? We're back.
Oh, yes, we are, Cardiff. And there's a lot to talk about.
Is there really? You don't say. We got to tell people, Ben, that we are recording not just on Thursday, April 17th, 2025. It's 3:12 in the afternoon. I think it's important to be specific about this. Who knows what just happened? You just checked the Wall Street Journal to make sure there were no updates right before we started, and I think that was good of you. That's really important.
3:12 Eastern.
As precise as possible. Let's do disclaimers, and then let's get on with the show.
Before we get started, I want to remind you that this podcast is not investment advice. It is intended for informational and entertainment purposes only.
Perfect. And this is the We're Back Because Everything is Falling Apart, So Let's Go Through It episode, I think. You have a really interesting idea for what to discuss today. You want to share with our listeners what we're going
to
do?
To me, it was mind-blowing, but I learned, probably after you did, because you're more in the know than me on this stuff, was that Steve Moran, who is the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors for the president, wrote a roadmap of how to restructure global trade. He wrote it and published it in November 2024. And I read that document, and my God, does it track what they have tried to do.
It's called literally A User's Guide to Restructuring the Global Trading System, written in November 2024. Little did we know that the user that would be implementing the user's guide is literally Donald Trump. It's the Trump administration, and that is what they're doing. If you read through the paper, and you and I are now going to discuss it, but if our listeners read through the paper, they'll see a lot of similarities between what's been attempted by the Trump administration in the last few weeks in terms of their tariff policies and what's in that paper. However, we should note what's really interesting is the predictions made by Steven Moran about what would happen in response to the implementation of this policy. And there's a few discrepancies, I think it's fair to say. So we're going to talk first about what's in the paper, what it said was a good way to go about implementing tariffs and the rationale behind it, and then what actually happened and its consequences. So we're ready. Where do you want to start? Do you want to start by sharing what's in the paper in terms of like what specifically Steven Moran thought was a good idea?
The idea is, if you realize that there is this document they're working off, if you'd want to know what the document said they were going to do, because I think they're not done doing it. And there's a few things in the document they talk about wanting to do that might still happen. And then I think you and I should also do some scenarios of how they might play out, because I love doing scenario planning with you. I prepared to do three scenarios. So we'll sort of walk through what I'm calling Trump's roadmap, and then we can do the scenarios how we think it plays out. So, wow, I don't want to bore people about this paper. It was 41 pages. It took me a while to get through. It has a bunch of premises that I think are really interesting. The goals of rebuilding U.S. manufacturing is a shared goal with Biden, but with a very different approach.
Radically different approach. That's actually a good place to start, which is what is the rationale behind this policy in the first place? And what Moran says is that essentially the U.S. dollar has been persistently overvalued for a very long time, for decades. And the reason is that other countries have taken steps to undervalue their own currencies. And this has had some trade-offs in terms of the problems that you just mentioned for manufacturing. It's had some benefits too. So maybe that's where we should start, which is sort of Moran's slash Trump's view of the world and what's happening right now.
It's funny because most people have argued for 50 years that having the reserve currency is an exorbitant privilege. It's an asset. But here recently, they've reframed it as a liability. And they say, because we have the reserve currency, other countries have to hold our currency. And as a result, it gets overvalued. And that's bad for our exports. Our exports are not as competitive if our dollar is overvalued. And so they go about in this document explaining how they're going to try to level the playing field.
In other words, over time, to gradually revalue the dollar so that American exports and specifically American manufacturing exports are more competitive with the rest of the world. And essentially what Moran sees as other countries undervaluing their currencies artificially, this is our attempt to issue a countervailing strategy to offset that.
And that was to raise tariffs and thereby, in their view, make it more fair for Americans.
That tariff policy effectively would be used for a few different things, but also to be used as negotiating leverage. And I think what's interesting about this paper is that all throughout, Moran tries to tie it to other things. He ties it to defense policy, where effectively he says the U.S. has been providing this public good for the rest of the world, where we've been defending Europe, Japan, and other parts of the world, essentially not for free, but basically for free. We've been giving it away, and tariffs can raise revenues and in some senses offset the cost of providing that global public good. And it can be used as a negotiating strategy specifically against China, which is a focus of this paper and which has also obviously been a focus of, I don't know, the last how many presidential administrations as well, not just Trump now, but the prior Trump admin, Biden, even Obama, that has been a part of it. So that is part of the goal. And in terms of the implementation, we should note it's a little different from the way they did it.
Yeah, there seems to be two main problems with the paper. One is that some of the premises I disagree with, and then second, some of the predictions turned out to be very wrong. So the way I approached analyzing it was to look at the premises and walk through the premises I think seemed to be incorrect. And then we can talk about the predictions of how they thought their policy would play out and how that has been largely incorrect as well so far.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's go through the premises, rapid fire edition almost. Go for it.
The argument that the dollar has been strong because it's a global reserve asset is spotty in terms of the history. The dollar has traded within a large range. When I look at that range of when it's been strong and when it's been weak, it seemed to me very, very highly correlated with the performance of the U.S. economy and the U.S. stock market.
Yeah, and especially the outperformance of the economy relative to other economies throughout the world.
Yes, and so you look at from 2010 to 2025, and it's been rallying, the dollar's been appreciating for that 15-year period. I look at that and say, well, during those 15 years, the U.S. really outperformed the world. We had Mag 7, FANG, and the foreign investors were pouring money into the U.S. economy because of the exceptional performance of U.S. businesses. Only a year ago, there was this argument U.S. is the only game in town. And also, you go look at when the U.S. dollar collapsed. It collapsed from 2000 to 2004. It fell 30% from 2000 to 2004. And again, that's when you saw the internet bubble collapse and the decline of the U.S. stock market. So it seems to me it's much more correlated with performance of U.S. assets than it is with the reserve currency argument.
There's a famous cover of The Economist magazine from last year. I think it was only somewhere 4, 5, 6 months ago that had the U.S. on the cover. And it said the envy of the world in reference to the U.S. economy because of how extensively it had outperformed all other advanced economies in the world, and especially given the renewed weakness in the Chinese economy last year. So that speaks to your point that a lot of the reason behind the dollar's strength simply had to do with the fact that the U.S. was doing better than everywhere else. And so I think that somewhat gives a lie to the idea that Moran was saying that it's just because other countries crave the asset. There's something to that. But it's not as simple as that. I think it's a little bit more complicated. And that outperformance certainly had a big role to play.
We'll come back to this idea that people have to hold the dollar because you're seeing that prediction not play out. Another one is that the U.S. provides this global reserve currency benefit, which facilitates trade and stability to the world. And we provide it essentially for free. That's not true. In particular, if you look at it from a almost pure quantitative point of view, there's about $10 trillion of foreign reserves and foreign holdings of U.S. treasuries. So if you think about it, approximately $10 trillion held by foreigners, and we tax them every year with inflation. When we print more dollars, that makes the dollars that foreigners hold worth less. So they pay an inflation tax when they hold dollars, and the U.S. government prints money. That has ranged as low as 2% a year, which is about $200 billion a year, to as high as 20% during the inflation spike, which was $2 trillion. The foreign holdings of U.S. dollar assets does result in a fairly large indirect payment to the U.S. Treasury through an inflation adjustment.
The other point to make about that is that the dollar being persistently overvalued also means that people's standard of living inside the U.S. is a little higher because they can afford more foreign goods. I mean, that is just a straightforward point to make. Simultaneously, if we're just going by advantages and disadvantages in a simple roster, it gives the U.S. authorities the ability to sanction other countries. And so in some sense, when other countries pursue a strategy where they have to hold U.S. dollar assets, they are also strategically making themselves more vulnerable to, I don't want to say the whims of U.S. authorities, but the potency, the power of the U.S. authorities to issue sanctions that are actually going to be effective because so many transactions throughout the world are done in U.S. dollars. To your point, not totally free.
There's another argument in the document, which is that trade deficits are bad. I feel like it implies that trade deficits cause budget deficits, but in reality, budget deficits, federal budget deficits, cause trade deficits. Because when you have to borrow more money to finance the government, it raises interest rates. If the U.S. has a higher interest rate, it's more attractive to foreigners. And so what ends up happening is that the budget deficit actually drives the trade deficit because it attracts more foreign investment into treasuries.
On the trade deficit is bad or good issue, I think this more exists on like a spectrum of trade-offs. This is one where I can understand if the trade deficit gets really, really big, that effectively what that means is that we lose a little bit of control over monetary policy. And the rationale, and we saw this before the 2008 crisis, is that because there's such a demand for treasuries, it can lower their interest rates, you know, on the long end at least. And so what that ends up doing is that the Fed, which controls directly short-term rates, will control those rates, but then the long end won't respond the way the Fed might want. And you don't lose total control over monetary policy. There's the expectations channel and all that stuff. But it does make it a little bit harder to conduct that policy. I can understand why there are trade-offs there, but it doesn't automatically mean that everything about a large trade deficit is bad. Again, trade-offs, and it's important to understand them. It's not quite as black and white as I thought Stephen Moran did portray it in the piece.
I guess I'm interjecting a little bit of opinion here, but if you wanted to pursue a policy to balance your trade deficits, I think it would be very important to first balance your budget deficit. It's hard to control your trade deficit if you are a forced borrower at the federal level because you have a huge amount of federal debt and a huge amount of federal ongoing deficit. One of the things that made their predictions incorrect was that the size of the deficit and the size of the federal debt made it more difficult for them to effectuate their tariff policy.
So those are the premises.
Few premises seem to be wrong or strangely reasoned. And then some of the predictions. Okay, here we go. Maybe you want to go because we probably have a bunch of the predictions that what they said they thought would happen with the policy and then what ended up happening.
The first is I should note that Moran did call for only a gradual implementation of tariffs. He made the point, for example, that if you put in place a scheduled rise, gradual rise in tariffs on China, that that gives you sort of constant negotiating leverage against China. And also it establishes a certain amount of predictability for investors and for companies, businesses all throughout the country. We didn't do any of that. We just jacked up tariffs to extraordinarily high levels on China. I think the last I checked, it was at 130 or 40 something percent, which is outrageously high if there ends up being no walk back. And it happened quite suddenly. Moran had this interesting jujitsu move where he said that first, the dollar would be slightly overvalued or increase in value because of the tariffs, which is what you would normally expect. And that over time, only over time, would there be a gradual weakening in the dollar. Well, none of that happened. Instead, what happened was that there was an extremely sudden, aggressive, spiky decline in the dollar against the rest of the world. And it happened at the same time that yields on the long end were going up. This is sort of the worst of all worlds because the weaker dollar means you're going to have inflationary pressures and the higher rates means that there's going to be an anti-stimulating impulse on the U.S. economy. That was just one massive, massive failed prediction. What do you think?
They based a lot of their thinking on what happened as a result of the 2019 tariffs. Trump negotiated a tariff on China called the Phase One Agreement. And the result of that was that the dollar appreciated and there was very little inflation impact on the U.S. as a result of these tariffs on China. I think we were about 25%. And so their takeaway was, oh, you can put tariffs on China, and between the Chinese companies absorbing some of the costs of it and the rising dollar, the impact on American consumers will be muted or limited. And so that's what they extrapolated forward. And what ended up happening so far is the opposite. The dollar depreciated and there were tariffs. So you ended up with a double whammy on inflation.
That's exactly right. And part of this was also meant to be that because you'd have this gradual system in place, that other countries would then take the hint and stop undervaluing their currencies. And so you'd get the immediate rise in the dollar, but then over time, it would then weaken to where it should be, to what the sort of global marketplace dictates it should be. That is just not happening. Instead, it got front run. The other thing is the entire aim of this policy is to rejuvenate U.S. manufacturing. Well, what have we seen since the tariffs were announced? Absolute bloodletting in the American manufacturing sector. Industrial production has taken a massive hit. And if you look at surveys of manufacturing companies, they are suffering mightily. This is doing the exact opposite of what it was hoped for. And it's easy to see why this policy has been implemented with such radical uncertainty. The tariffs implemented were super high, and the falling dollar on top of the tariffs now make it so that companies that need to import a lot of intermediate products are really struggling to do that. It makes it so that their entire business becomes uneconomical. And a lot of companies, by the way, they use Chinese factories or factories overseas to make most of the products, which they then import to sell to American customers. Well, that's no longer economical. And so the people who were based here, employed here, they're going to lose their jobs. This has been so far a total catastrophe for American manufacturing, not exactly what was supposed to happen.
I've read that trucking and global freight has both fallen 50%. That's sort of a sign that there's a lot less manufacturing and trade. The other thing that's strange about the policy is that if you wanted to increase exports, you would necessarily want to exempt exports from the import tax. About 25 to 30% of all of the inputs into manufacturing a U.S. export is an import. So if you make an airplane, a lot of the components are imported, cabling or printer circuit boards, the PCBs. There's a lot of inputs in U.S. manufacturing that are coming from supply chains around the world. By not exempting exports from this tariff, you actually have made U.S. exports much less competitive, and the consequence has driven up the price of our exports. So on average, I think our exports are now going to be 11% more expensive because 30% of the inputs are being tariffed. So that's another sort of really strange part of the policy. I assume they're going to fix that. It didn't make sense to me.
The other prediction, by the way, was that the potential for Chinese and other retaliation was less than what we've seen played out, at least so far. This has been a really fascinating part of the discussion the last couple of weeks, which is the idea that because the U.S. is running these huge trade deficits against these other countries, that they are the ones who are going to have to submit because we're the buyers. They're not going to find ready substitutes to buy their products elsewhere in the world. The part that that omits, though, is that there are a lot of things that we import that we really need. That becomes a problem if, for example, you look at China, which has now essentially suspended exports of rare earths, which American companies use to make all kinds of things. That's a problem. Okay, we've got the money, but they've got the stuff. So it's not entirely the case that other places can't retaliate. In fact, we've seen them already start to retaliate, starting with China, which is now not going to buy as much American energy products. I think they put in place some kind of a ban on buying Boeing.
Soybeans,
oil seeds and grains and things like that. This is not necessarily the case that other places can't retaliate just because we have the money. Okay, but they've got the stuff. And we're going to have to get that somewhere, and it's going to be a lot more expensive to get it, or we're going to have to make do without for at least a while until we figure something else out. the chance to hurt each other is very, very high going in both directions. I think it's important to point that out.
Yeah, one more thing that is both a premise and a prediction, and that is that foreigners had to hold U.S. dollars, U.S. assets. But what's happened is that foreigners have been selling the heck out of our U.S. assets, and as a result, the stock market has been falling and interest rates have been rising because foreign investors have been exiting the U.S. market, in part because the dollar has been falling. And if you are a foreign investor and the dollar falls 10%, your assets worth 10% less. And so that has started a bit of a vicious cycle, because the more the dollar falls, the more foreign investors sell, which then drives the dollar down more. The concept that the foreign investor had to hold U.S. assets has so far turned out to be not correct.
I would stress just how unusual this is. If you look at previous episodes of U.S. stock market freakouts, it's usually accompanied by people flocking to U.S. treasuries as the global safe haven. In this case, what seems to have happened instead is that there's just been a generalized loss of confidence in U.S. assets, period, including the very safest one. We've been discussing the problems with everything that's happened. I don't want to be too alarmist too quickly either. It's not like the rise in yields or the sell-off in the dollar has gotten to financial crisis levels or anything like that. But the trend has been so sharp and so quick that it's worth looking at what on earth just happened and how strange this is for things to be going in this direction instead of the direction they historically go in when there's a freakout, a sort of risk-off freakout in U.S. assets. The one U.S. asset that usually benefits is also suffering this time, and that's treasuries.
So I don't want some of our listeners to think we're only negative here, and I feel like we've been flogging the Trump administration here. I want to do some positive scenarios, but so far the policy has some poor implementation. And I just want to mention two more things that were in the roadmap, in Steve Moran's roadmap, that have not yet happened. But in the roadmap, they're saying they plan to do. And they seem to me to be bold and risky. The first one that I think I wonder if they're going to shelve is taxing foreign official holdings of U.S. treasuries. So Steve Moran says that foreign governments have to hold U.S. treasuries in order to keep their currencies low. They have to hold U.S. dollars, and they hold them in reserves. And so we should start to tax them through a withholding. Everybody knows if you get a dividend of 10%, you're going to withhold some percentage of it to pay taxes. It's something that actually a lot of countries do, where if you invest in Canada, for example, you're going to have to withhold and pay to the Canadian government a tax on that dividend as a foreign investor. And so that's a policy that Steve Moran is recommending that we do in order to discourage foreign holders of U.S. reserve assets and then drive down the dollar.
I have a feeling that that's not just off the table. It's not in the room anymore, given the specific response of the market to the initial round of tariffs, which, by the way, that response is still ongoing. I think if you were to also then introduce an idea to start taxing foreign holdings of treasuries, the treasury freakout that's already taken place would just escalate to really troubling places. I don't actually think that that's likely at this point. Worth monitoring for sure. It was in the paper, but I don't think that's coming.
My two comments on that are, one, you might be surprised.
I have been so far.
And then two, it just shows you their thinking, that they believe that the foreign investors had to hold treasuries, and they'd even hold the treasuries if we tax them by some amount. And so events have so far proven that to be incorrect, but it is illustrative of their logic underneath this plan. And the other thing I think actually will happen, and I think it's going to be very interesting to see what they do with it, is the sovereign wealth fund. I've heard this now a few times, and it's in the paper, and I'll give you what I think is the plan. But like all these things, you sort of hear echoes of it. And then when it happens, you look back and you're like, it was there in plain sight, but I didn't really appreciate it. I think it looks something like this. In the paper, there's a provision in the law that lets a treasury buy and sell currencies. Currently, that fund holds about $40 billion in assets. I believe they're going to revalue gold, which would put equivalent of $800 billion into that fund. The mechanism I've understood is that if you valued gold at fair market today, that would revalue it from about tens of billions to almost a trillion. You put $1 trillion into this emergency fund. Scott Bessent, who is famous for currency trading, in the document describes selling dollars and executing some sort of strategy to force other countries to appropriately value their currency.
It was essentially offered as a possible countervailing measure, a sort of counter manipulation of the currency. And Moran listed a whole bunch of different possible metrics or indicators to look at to decide if a country was in fact manipulating its currency. This would be an idea for how to essentially buy foreign currencies and foreign assets to essentially offset it. And then Moran, by the way, did go through like the risks of that, of what it would mean for the U.S. to hold a large amount of reserves of other countries' currencies and other countries' assets. The risks are essentially what those countries are now running by holding so many dollars and so many dollar-based assets, just in reverse, but as an offsetting mechanism.
He says they may do to us what we're planning to do to them, which is to tax the holdings of those assets. I just want to point out that there are two big strategies that are in that document that have not been rolled out and may not get rolled out, but if they do, which would be a sovereign wealth fund and then taxing foreign holdings of reserve assets, they would have huge consequences.
Totally agree with that. They would have huge consequences. And as you said, we might be surprised. I just sort of have a feeling that managing the fallout of what's happened in the last few weeks for at least a while is what's going to keep everybody busy. The extent to which like some of the tariffs stay, how we use them as negotiating leverage on different countries, not just on China, whether or not there's any walkbacks. That is such a big endeavor itself to figure out for the administration that I have a feeling that these two options for now are off the table. But as you said, who knows? Maybe as part of a further negotiation, they'll come back to the table and say, we could do this stuff. I just don't know. Worth following for sure.
We'll follow it. I think that we'll see something to do with this Bessent Sovereign Wealth Fund and how it might trade in other currencies. I think that will actually end up in the news at some point and have interesting consequences. But okay, to try to satisfy some of my listeners who feel like we're too critical of the one party versus another, I want to do a scenario where it works. The scenario where they pull it off, and I'm going to try to make a scenario where I'm for it, where all of this, which seems up till now messy, not looking so good, turns out to be genius and it plays out. And I'm going to walk through what that argument would look like. And I know a lot of smart people who think this is true, think that this is actually going to work out. And I know a lot of smart people who think the opposite. I'm not trying to alienate either side. I think that there are some good arguments for why it could work out.
I love this idea. And I've got my best case scenario in mind too, but why don't you go first?
I feel like yours is not going to be as positive as mine.
Possibly.
Because I know some people who worked with Scott Bessent, Treasury Secretary, and they really think he's a genius and they think that he has a plan. And so I'm going to try to outline what they're telling me and make this argument that they're making, which is that this is a negotiation and what you're seeing is brinksmanship from Trump, but there's actually he's following a playbook or a template. And I can give you two other times he's done this in the past and how they played out, because I think it's illustrative of their thinking in the it all works out scenario.
I'm excited. Let's do this.
So two other times where something very similar happened was the first one is the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. When Trump came into office, he used inflammatory language. I'll give you some quotes. He said, NAFTA has been a disaster for the United States. So NAFTA was the North American Free Trade Agreement. I think it signed into law under Clinton. A lot of people feel like that hurt U.S. manufacturing, and a lot of people think it helped. But Trump said it was a disaster. He said, quote, Mexico is absolutely a threat to the United States of America. He also said, when Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're bringing rapists. So these are really inflammatory language. He put 25% tariffs on steel, 10% on aluminum, 25% tariffs on autos where he threatened. He threatened a Section 232 investigation. All of these things we're talking about now are exactly what he's doing right now to China. And he also talked about putting tariffs on dairy. Extreme language, extreme behavior, aggressive tariffs. And then they ultimately did tear up NAFTA and renegotiated a whole new agreement called the USMCA, United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement. And what were the final results of that agreement? I'm going to compare what NAFTA had versus what USMCA ended up with. So under NAFTA, for a good to be considered a North American good, it had to be 62.5% manufactured in North America. The new agreement raised that to 75% of the vehicle had to be manufactured in America. So from 62.5 to 75%, at least 40 to 45% of the vehicle had to be manufactured in a high wage area, i.e. not Mexico, Canada, or US. US gained access to 3.6% of Canada's dairy market. Canada gave us access to 3.6% of their eggs and milk market. And then a bunch of smaller things around strengthening environmental labor provisions, extending copyright from 50 years to 70 years, and some protections for the digital economy. And that was where they ended up. So considering how extreme the language and behavior was from before to the actual agreement in the end, it was very modest change to the status quo. And the actual facts on the ground were slightly better for the United States, but certainly not dramatic.
The USMCA turned out to be a little bit of a nothing burger. It was NAFTA rewritten, a few things to let the president essentially say, look, I just negotiated this incredible agreement. I should say that in this case, the one difference is just that they've gone so much further and a lot of the things have in fact been implemented. People sort of forget this. Those car tariffs have gone into effect. They're there now. It's enormous. But I think I know where you're going with this, which is a lot of the stuff we're doing now is leading to a much milder place than where we currently are or where the president suggested we might go.
That's the template from the past. And I'm going to do the other one, which was the Trump-China trade deal called the Phase One Trade Agreement. Again, very, very inflammatory language. China's ripping us off on trade. China has been cheating us for years. We're going to make them pay. And then the actual agreement is pretty modest. They end up with some protections for IP, some patents. They agree to buy $200 billion of U.S. exports. They agreed to not manipulate their currency. There's some reforms and there's some modest tariffs. So what was a high drama negotiation ended up with a pretty reasonable agreement between the two parties where a little bit of a win-win, certainly not a huge zero-sum game win-loss that we're currently imagining is going to happen in the world.
So is that your best case scenario? Mine's way more positive than that, but go ahead.
I'm saying that what ends up happening, they go around the world, they collect deals from countries. I have some examples of types of things. South Africa and Australia open up their markets to natural resources. Germany opens up their market to automakers. India opens up their markets to U.S. agriculture and U.S. tech. Japan and South Korea. Here's an interesting stat. In Korea, U.S. spends $13.5 billion a year maintaining our 28,500 active duty troops on the line between North Korea and South Korea. Currently, South Korea only pays 43% of that, $5.8 billion a year. So you can imagine South Korea saying, we'll pay you more. We'll write a check to the Treasury, help pay for defense. Same thing in Japan. We have 53,000 active duty military in Japan, costs us $21 billion a year. Japan pays for 60% of that. Maybe they pay for more. So you go down the list and say, okay, you could see a bunch of countries actually lowering their barriers for U.S. companies, writing checks, and we end up in a more free trade world with our allies. And you see a really positive situation for all the big countries. I think that we end up leaving 10% tariffs on all the small countries. So that's where like a Vietnam or a Malaysia ends up having to pay tariffs to the U.S., because they just don't have enough to offer us. Small countries pay us tariffs. Big countries give us more access. And then I think China ends up making a deal where they agree to more fair treatment of U.S. companies. And maybe they agree to pay tariffs and open some U.S. factories. So maybe that's not as positive as you were imagining. At the end of this road, which is probably about 3 to 6 months from now, the world's trade is actually better. U.S. manufacturers are a little bit better off in terms of their access to other markets. And I've seen different forecasts of how much new manufacturing brings to the U.S. I've seen Goldman Sachs says 100,000 more U.S. workers in the manufacturing industry, and ChatGPT forecast up to 500,000. So there's 12 million U.S. factory workers. We may see an extra 100,000 to 500,000 additional U.S. manufacturing workers and additional sort of exports. So that's the kind of success I think that could happen. Maybe you're more optimistic.
Maybe just slightly more, but that's pretty close. I won't belabor the details, but the point about making a deal with essentially the rest of the world, non-China, is in my best case scenario, where effectively trade barriers maybe even end up going lower than they were before. We maybe even reestablish some kind of way to adjudicate trade disputes, but from a lower base of trade barriers than existed. So tariff rates go effectively back down close to zero. And yes, that actually does, in my best case scenario, include the smaller countries. They offer us something that's just nominal. And they sort of acknowledge, yeah, sure, listen, we do export a lot of stuff to you guys. We appreciate it. And they throw in a sweetener. I don't know what it would be, but they figure it out diplomatically. And then specifically to China, the dream scenario there is that on all non-national security related products, that trade barriers come down again. By national security related products, I think it's fair to leave your guard up a little bit in both directions. So things that have to do with semiconductors, AI, chips, those kinds of things, probably there's no getting around that the world from now on will simply have large trade barriers, exports and import controls on those kinds of goods. But that on everything else, the Trump administration essentially realizes that, for example, young families don't want to have to pay so much more money for baby strollers and diapers and things like that, that we actually do import a lot of low value, low tech goods that we should have no interest in manufacturing here in this country because it would represent a huge climb down the value chain. So we go back to importing that stuff and intermediate goods, no big deal, tariffs fall as much as they possibly can again. And essentially, we just leave a little bit there for the national security related items and maybe for some items that have to do with resiliency. So like making things in this country that we don't want to have to depend too much on or entirely on foreign countries in a crisis. Okay, we go back to like making that stuff again. We don't kill the Chips and Science Act as has been threatened because that actually seemed to have been working to construct new fabs, new factories in the country. We leave that there. That's part of trade policy too. But we go back to that and everything else falls as much as possible because of some extraordinary deals that the deal maker in chief makes. And there you go. So that is, in my head, the best case scenario. Likely? No. But we're scenario planning here. And I think that would be marvelous.
Somehow the scenario in Trump's administration's view is that we leave tariffs high enough on China that they pay us tariffs and that marginal tariff brings back to the U.S. the marginal manufacturing that we do want. And again, you said some of them, I'll just name a few, machine tools, robotic parts, active pharmaceutical ingredients, different kinds of electronics, capacitors and resistors. Those things are all manufactured in China. Maybe we want to manufacture them here, maybe. And I think that there's some kind of best case scenario, which I'm having trouble figuring how to get from here to there, where we do manufacture those things here. China helps us transition. It would probably take 5 years to get to a place where we're really able to manufacture them efficiently. And somehow China agrees to help us with that transition and maybe pay us along the way in exchange for continued access for the rest of the U.S. consumers. Not exactly sure how you get there, but I feel like that would be the best case scenario.
An extraordinary feat of diplomacy.
Yes.
China or any other country doesn't pay us tariffs. American importers always pay tariffs. It's a tax on them. But those other countries suffer from our tariffs because they end up not being able to sell as much to us. But all the revenue that's generated from it would come from American importers paying it. It's just that we would be importing less stuff on the stuff that's tariffed by definition. In terms of China helping us to develop some of the high-tech stuff that they've made, oh man, wouldn't that be like an extraordinary diplomatic outcome? That stuff tends to happen instead by threat. And what you're seeing most incredibly, actually, is that the Europeans are essentially saying, sure, we'll let you sell some of your BYD EVs here, but first you have to like agree to share some of the knowledge behind how to make it. It's sort of the reversal of how things have worked for the last half century, where it was China that was trying to acquire the knowledge behind how to make the high-tech goods. Well, in this case, China has leapfrogged the rest of the world when it comes to EVs specifically. They're now making the very best EV and the cheapest EV that you can get. And it's the Europeans demanding that the Chinese share the knowledge with them. So could something like that happen for some products in the US? Oh man, given the geopolitics of this, the superpower rivalry, I really doubt it, but this is best case scenario. This is scenario planning. So I'm in. I'd love for that to happen.
Maybe I have a different best case scenario now that you've said it, because let me just finish yours and do a slight modification to the best case scenario. So finishing yours is that happened with the Plaza Accords with Japan, where Reagan dropped the hammer on Japan and they agreed to manufacture Japanese cars in America. And they opened up factories across the South. You could see, okay, maybe China does what Japan did and they open up BYD and other types of manufacturing in America. That's one version. Sorry, I actually just realized the other best case scenario for the Trump administration is somehow the world agrees to ring fence China and the world essentially can do without China. The manufacturing that China is currently doing, it ends up getting done in the United States or in friendly countries. And we transition over the course of a few years. And that transition is not so painful in terms of inflation and in terms of not having certain types of goods that you normally get from China. Somehow the world agrees to shift away from China. And from a geopolitical point of view, China is now contained and the US is now ascendant.
That ring fencing part for me, again, applies specifically to national security related stuff. International IP espionage, things like that, certain kinds of goods, semiconductors, things that can be used for surveillance, whatever, things like that. The reason I don't want to ring fence China entirely to cut it off from the rest of the world is that I actually think that leads to a more dangerous world rather than a less dangerous one. I'm not saying that commerce with another country solves all the world's political problems. We've seen that it does not. But the truth is, I just don't see a world in which China is completely isolated from everybody else that makes China a less dangerous adversary rather than a more dangerous adversary. If there's absolutely no interdependence going in either direction, it then would have nothing to lose geopolitically from starting a war or whatever, pursuing some kind of territorial conquest. My best case scenario still includes a lot of trade with China, just not on those national security.
I have a hard time imagining the world agreeing to ring fence China. And I have a hard time imagining actually the United States having no trade with China. In practice, I think it's very difficult to pull off considering the costs. And I thought maybe in scenario two, we could walk through why that is so difficult and maybe a less positive scenario or a bad one, but also helps you understand why a good scenario where somehow US is completely independent of China is not very realistic and maybe not even a good thing, as you're saying.
In this case, what is scenario two exactly? This is the part where the Trumpian policies fail and now we define what failure looks like. Is that right?
Again, I think there's a few versions of this, unfortunately. I think we have to start walking through some of the challenges and some of the ways it falls apart. And then maybe it shows why your scenario of actually trade with China is good as long as you have put up barriers around things that are critical national security. It's a more traditional point of view. It's globalist, liberal in the sense of liberalism.
Classical liberal. Hey, listen, neoliberalism is back, baby. We are back. The one thing that the market freakout has accomplished, okay, is that it has once again brought the stigma to protectionism, which was the concept du jour for all this time, man.
I don't know. You're celebrating too soon.
That's part of scenario one. That's best case scenario intellectually, scenario one. For a generation or two, protectionist, isolationist, nativist impulses are done. They're discredited. That's part of scenario one. But you're right. We're in scenario two. So let's go.
I wanted to walk through some facts about why it would be difficult to do without China. Ahead of this podcast, I did some preparation. I was looking at China's manufacturing strength. And it's just staggering. So I just thought I'd give you a few stats. It makes you appreciate why it would be very difficult for the world to abandon China's manufacturing industrial base. I mean, it's the world's manufacturer. There are 12 million workers in the United States in the manufacturing sector. There are 100 million in China, just in the manufacturing sector. China produces 2 times the electricity per person that the United States does, but we know they have a salary or wages that are 5 times less than the US. So they produce so much more power, and that goes to manufacturing. So for the United States to try to do without Chinese manufacturing, you're missing 88 million workers, and you'd have to produce a hell of a lot more electricity than the United States. I mean, you'd have to triple US electricity production, just if you're saying if you're trying to do it all in the United States or somewhere else in the world. But that's a lot of infrastructure and a lot of workers who are highly skilled to replicate China's manufacturing industrial base. They think it would cost about $30 to $35 trillion to rebuild China's manufacturing and industrial base. That would mean the US would have to take 10% of their GDP for 10 years, or the world does.
Not to mention the logistical challenge of replicating the know-how, the process knowledge, which doesn't come easy. That's partly the result of the extraordinary experience and focus the Chinese economy has had over the last few decades. It wouldn't just be a matter of spending the money. It would be a matter of regaining, replicating the knowledge. Those are incredible numbers and worth keeping in mind. I should add that the despair over the U.S. manufacturing sector is itself overdone. The U.S. has about 16% of the world's manufacturing output by at least one metric and 4% of the population. So we actually do punch way above our weight when it comes to manufacturing output. We have fewer workers in the sector because the U.S. economy is close to the production frontier. That means that it is just more technologically sophisticated than it used to be. Therefore, it's more efficient, more innovative, more productive. So the idea that we don't make anything or that nobody works in the sector just isn't quite true. It's fewer people as a share of the total economy than in the past, but that is normal. It's normal for that sort of thing to happen, for it to decline. By the way, it's happening in other countries, including China and Germany, which have run huge trade surpluses for the last few decades. A lot of this stuff is just way overdone, the despair. I love that point about the Chinese manufacturing sector being so dominant that replicating it is a near impossibility. There would be an absolutely massive cost to the US and global economy of trying to just suddenly shut it out like that.
You're right. I mean, the funny thing about US manufacturing is it's the second largest in the world. China's is the largest, but US is the second largest by a huge measure. Clearly, we could manufacture more here, and that's actually a policy that Biden also pursued with the CHIPS Act and the Green Infrastructure Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, which helped try to onshore a lot of green technologies. There's a shared goal. In this scenario, the policy backfires. I called this the 3 underestimates. The Trump administration is underestimating how hard it is to execute this, the speed of execution of trying to negotiate all these deals around the world, that they underestimate the complexity of the global economy and the global market, and they underestimate China. They're underestimating the actual ability to pull off what they're ostensibly trying to pull off. As a consequence, it falls apart. And so we should walk through what that looks like. To some extent, the reality's actually much closer to it already falling apart so far than to it actually succeeding.
So scenario 2, to be clear, is the worst case scenario outcome here. These policies fail and it has these cascading effects and things fall apart.
Yeah. Some of those things, which I'm sure you have your list.
Oh, I'm ready. I'm ready.
Okay.
I think my worst case scenario is that the trade war continues in exactly the shape that it's in right now, which is to say that there is continued escalation with China, driving trade between the US and China down close to zero. If you look at where tariffs are right now, that is a realistic possibility, or at least so low that you essentially round down to zero, that would impose massive costs on American businesses and on American consumers. That resulting weakness would continue the sell-off of U.S. assets, all U.S. assets, including treasuries, which means higher interest rates. It means higher inflation, which makes it really hard for the Fed to respond because effectively we're then looking at a stagflationary scenario of lower growth, a fall into recession, and higher inflation. And there's no avoiding it if it gets that bad. So what ends up happening then is that political pressure builds on the Fed. You end up wiping out the central bank's independence, and that threat has already started, as we've seen just this week. And you end up then with a really bad outcome, which is a politicized central bank, and that exacerbates the sell-off of U.S. assets. And then on top of it, the approach that we're trying to take with geopolitical allies, who we've just treated to 10% tariffs, does not lead to any kind of a diplomatic solution where we end up then effectively trying to use them to gang up on China. But instead, what those other countries do is they renew their own closeness with China. And then the U.S. is effectively the country that becomes more and more isolated and ring-fenced over time. We start falling even further into absolute widespread economic catastrophe. And that leads to all kinds of other cascading consequences, like a financial crisis, a further sell-off, and then more policies that isolate us, and the whole thing gets worse and worse and worse. So the dreaded vicious cycle begins. So that is the worst case scenario. Again, as with scenario one, it's not what I consider to be the likely outcome, but it is the worst case scenario is that we end up in an absolute economic spiral. It's not likely. It's not my base case, but it has become just plausible enough that it makes me super uncomfortable.
My worst case wasn't as bad as that, is what I think is the likely worst case. Places where I agree with you. So I thought it was interesting when you look at what the inflationary impact would be. The different measures I've seen quoted talk about inflation as a national inflationary number. So maybe it rises another 3 to 4%. So it goes from about 3 to 6 or 7. But for people who that doesn't mean anything, that's close to the inflation levels when inflation was through the roof. It goes back to being as almost as bad or even worse than the worst period of 2022. That's the kind of inflation we're talking about. And it ends up being, in some ways, I think, more shocking to people because it's not inflation of wages, which there was a lot of service sector inflation in that period. This is really just inflation of goods. So you go to the store, you go to Walmart, and the thing you want to buy has a 50% tariff premium. Even at modest tariffs, if the tariffs end up at 15 to 20% and the dollar falls 20%, you're talking about a 40% shock to import prices. And so that's a huge impact for people, especially in the more moderate income people who end up spending a lot of money at Walmart or Target, and they find that those goods are a lot more expensive. So that ends up being a consumer tax and a consumer shock. The state of the economy going into this is so interesting. It was the opposite. We had a strong consumer who had saved a lot during the pandemic and was really powering the economy. So they end up getting shocked. And then the other part of it, I actually sat down with ChatGPT o3 last night, and o3 is the new OpenAI model. Tyler Cowen, my favorite economist in the world, I think the smartest person in the world, he said last night he thought it was AGI. Artificial general intelligence. Like, we've hit a place where there's a machine as smart as a person. In some ways, it's smarter. And I asked it, okay, here's my scenario, O3 model. We have tariffs of 10% on all countries and then 45 to 50% on China. The stock market then falls about 25% because this is a bad scenario where the stock market's been falling. And I think it would keep falling. So you have two negative shocks. A negative wealth effect shock, and also an inflation tax. It said it thought GDP would fall 2% and the Fed would have to drop rates by 225 basis points. So the Fed would end up basically collapsing under that recessionary pressure. At least 1 to 2 million people are thrown out of work. So it pushed unemployment to 5 to 6%. That's not even the worst case scenario. That's closer to a more of the same, but without China tariffs at 150%, but at 50%, which I think is closer to actually Trump's aims.
That is a lot closer, for example, to, I guess, my base case scenario, which we'll do next. That to me does not sound like the worst case scenario at all. If anything, I think that when you consider momentum effects, things can go a lot further. Uncertainty, especially if you combine it with the sell-off in the dollar, things of that nature, the sell-off of U.S. assets generally, like I absolutely could see the stock market falling by a lot more than 20 or 25% in that kind of a scenario. That's not just a wealth shock. It also represents an incredibly brutal environment for businesses to raise money just to keep themselves going. And that also would have a further effect on layoffs, bankruptcies, and so on, combined with the fact that interest rates are going to be high, deficit would have to explode as a result of it because revenues would be falling and there would be a lot of pressure to stimulate the economy in a scenario like that. But with not much firepower left, I just think that it would keep going and going and going. In a situation like that, yeah, okay, if there's a walk back on the tariffs, then you might get that. Not bad. People see, okay, well, things are worse than they used to be, so we get a recession. It's an off-the-rack recession rather than an actual crisis proper. But it's not bad. But in a scenario where it starts with a massive tariff-induced shock and then just keeps on going, I don't know what would stop it other than a walk back from the Trump administration.
But the challenge is that it takes time for Trump to be successful. You can't negotiate trade deals with a bunch of countries around the world very fast. I asked ChatGPT 03 again, like how long would it take? And when do you see like a deal with China and deal with Japan and UK, some of the more friendly players? And I basically thought it would take about 3 months. We keep seeing templates of deals. I think we start seeing the outlines of what a successful deal looks like relatively soon, maybe 30 days, but it takes a while for the uncertainty to start to get baked out of it. It takes a lot longer to get to a deal with China, especially because of the game theory dynamics where the two parties really are in a lose-lose situation. It's hard to come up with a win-win. Base case scenario of you have this shock, you have a lot of negative effects on the economy and on inflation, stock market, and on business investment. Without a deal with China, it's hard to really walk that back all that much.
That part I agree with. There's a dynamic here where the politics of both countries have become really tough. Neither side wants to be seen as the one that approaches the other. Neither side wants to be seen as the one that has offered concessions. It's tricky. I don't know how exactly you get around that.
Why don't you tell me your base case scenario, and then we can do a couple surprise scenarios.
That sounds good to me. My baseline prediction is that there is, in fact, a walk back from the Trump administration on a number of the tariffs that have been imposed, and also that enough damage has already been done that it's still too hard to avoid a downturn. Whether that's 0% growth or a recession, I'm not sure. I think those two things are functionally quite similar anyways, whether we're technically in a recession or whether growth slows enormously. So my base case scenario is that, especially with the rest of the world non-China, there is in fact some kind of a negotiated thing. There is a walk back. We don't go all in on China at 140%, that at some point we do get to something a little bit more reasonable and that there's not further escalation from here, that we're somewhere close to the peak of the tensions between us and China. But enough damage has been done. And the reason I'm worried is that even going into the tariff battles, even going into quote unquote Liberation Day, I thought the U.S. economy was already kind of in a precarious spot. Consumer spending growth had already started to slow down. We already knew that inflation-adjusted income growth was also going to be weaker this year than it was last year. There was a lot of uncertainty beforehand about what tariffs might be enacted. And I think there's maybe a little bit of a respite because a lot of people went out and bought stuff, especially cars, ahead of the tariffs coming in. And so it might take a minute for this to materialize. But if you think that growth was already pretty weak in the first quarter, and you look at the most recent estimates of what the tariffs might do, which is somewhere between like 1 to 2 percentage points of GDP growth this year, that to me signals enough damage to tip the U.S. into either a downturn or into an outright recession within the next year or so. I think that's coming. I believe that's where we're headed, and you can call that whatever you want, slowdown, recession, downturn, whatever. But that's my base case scenario. And of course, it's all contingent on the extent of the walk back. If there's a massive, essentially, settlement slash capitulation, if your best case scenario component that was, hey, we end up with something actually quite mild, I think you will see a big stock market rally. I think you will see the dollar rally when everybody realizes, oh my God, the thing we thought was going to happen, that we're in this totally new world, this totally new environment. We're not going down that path. We're just going to do a little bit the way we saw in Trump 1. If that happens, then it might be enough, and it might even be soon enough to avoid an outright recession. But my base case is at least one and likely or two quarters of negative GDP growth. So the unofficial version of a recession starts within the next year. That's my base case scenario.
I could see, again, in my positive scenario, a lot of good deals getting negotiated with a lot of friendly countries, and that ends up being probably comparable to your base case, because I think that it's going to take a little bit of time for that to play out, and the shock has already happened. So there's a pullback in business investment and hiring and things like that. And so I can see that coming together. I think that is likely to come together, that I think the Trump administration is not trying to punish allies if they can't get away with it. If the country is willing to push back, I think they'll be more like a Trump 1 negotiation with a Canada or Mexico or India or Japan. The part that I'm having trouble seeing in a base case scenario is how, even if you bring tariffs with China down to what Anna Wong said, which was 45%, 50%, she said that would cut trade with China down 60 to 70%. And that's also a price shock to American consumers. My question for you is, how do you see the inflationary pressures balancing out with the recessionary pressures? Because you have really two opposing forces playing out over the next 6 to 18 months. Can you walk me through how you see what's probably a mildly bad case, where you have much higher tariffs on China, but otherwise a free market world?
Typically, recessionary pressures would be disinflationary, or even in some cases, if they're really bad, deflationary. This is the problem with tariffs, is that you get this one-time massive price shock, which by the technical definition of inflation, you could say it's not inflationary because it's not persistent. It shows up in the inflation figures for this year because the prices go up. But over time, it doesn't raise persistently the inflation rate. That's the difference between a big increase in the price level versus something that is inflationary and continues to be inflationary over time. There's two problems. One is that the inflation rate was already too high for the Fed's comfort going into all this. It was running at about 2.5% a year, which is higher than the Fed's 2% target. And it had plateaued. In other words, it had stopped coming down the way it had been coming down last year, which means that there's not going to be a whole lot of help coming from the Fed when it comes to stimulating the economy if the rate still looks like it's there. The other problem is that Jerome Powell has said that he's a believer in the power of expectations. And if you get that one-time price shock and the inflation expectations that are higher set in, and we've seen inflation expectations already climb enormously, there is the risk that that becomes endogenous, that inflation expectations effectively lead to inflation itself being persistently higher. And that is really dangerous for the Fed to allow. And so what ends up happening is that you simultaneously have these recessionary pressures at the same time that you have inflationary pressures. And the only way to manage that is for the Fed essentially to say what Jerome Powell literally just said yesterday on April 16th, which is that he said, if we're missing on both of our targets of low inflation and high employment or low unemployment, that you have to put in place some idea of how far those two things are from the target and then try to balance them out. But it doesn't mean that you eradicate one at the expense of the other. It means that you, in some sense, have to tolerate both things being off target for a while, inflation too high and unemployment also being too high. And that is a tough place to be in, especially when the Fed is also facing all this political pressure from the White House. So there's no easy way to like manage that. There's no easy way to balance it. You can have both things at the same time. When you have what effectively amounts to a big supply shock, which is what tariffs represent. And in this case, it happens to be a self-inflicted one instead of a massive external shock like we had in the 1970s. But nonetheless, that is what it is.
My expectation is I started calling it higher for shorter rather than higher for longer.
Rather than lower for longer, higher for shorter.
Yeah. We were in a market where interest rates were going to stay higher for longer because inflation got stuck higher. And the way I think about what you just said is that the shock is a short-term shock in terms of prices, over time, that starts to diminish. And then the Fed has to shift to start cutting. And that starts happening maybe serendipitously about the same time that Trump replaces Powell with a new Fed chair in May of 2026, 12 months from now. I think that the Fed does end up having a cut, and they probably have to cut deeper when they finally cut. And so you end up going from a higher for shorter period to lower for longer. We almost go back to where we were in the early 2010s. Coming out of a bad recession, we don't have demographic growth like we did back then. We don't have maybe immigration. And so the only real way to grow out of it is productivity growth. And that productivity growth is probably AI, but that productivity growth is deflationary. And so we go to a period that's a lot like the 2010s.
The other problem, though, is that the productivity growth takes a hit in the downturn. You have less investment. You have less adoption of new technologies. It's a problem. But I agree with you that if you have a deep enough recession and it lasts long enough, eventually that stamps out the inflation. It's just that in a situation where you have both recessionary pressures and high inflation, that recession is going to have to be prolonged to essentially wait for the inflation to clear out because demand is so subdued for so long. So eventually, yeah, sure, that'll happen. But it means a lot of people suffer in the meantime before the Fed can effectively lower interest rates and stimulate the economy again in an environment where it is not risking higher inflation and higher inflation expectations setting in. As for like ongoing economic growth after that, it would help to have rising population growth via immigration. It looks like we're probably not going to have that, or at least some pro-growth policies. But if we also happen to still have high tariffs on the rest of the world and whatnot, that may not be there either. You almost need a recession to get so bad that you bottom out and then you can only go up from a lower base and after a whole lot of suffering. We're almost back in scenario two there. That's not my base case, but that's what would end up happening if there is no walk back.
My challenge with your base case is that I don't understand what your walk back is on China. And without a walk back on China, I don't see how you don't end up in the stagflationary downturn.
You might be right about that. My walk back on China, by the way, is that you get all the way back to the tariff rates that persisted before Liberation Day. In other words, they were a little bit higher from the start of the year when Trump raised tariffs on China, but that's basically it. You're not at 45 or 50%, which I think is what you said Anna Wong had it at. I think it was down closer to like 20, 25% or something like that. That is the walk back. So there's pain there, but it's a big walk back. And we basically go back to a world where, yeah, there's an impact on growth. There's an impact on inflation, but it's not what happens in a scenario where essentially we've made it completely uneconomical for anybody to have trade with China.
So your base case is pretty much a full walk back across the world on everything after April 2nd?
No, it's quite a large walk back. So on most of the world, we don't keep 10% tariffs. We end up lowering that through a series of negotiations. It takes some time again, but we lower them from where they are. That especially applies to Mexico and Canada. And with China, we do end up at some kind of a walk back. Maybe not on everything, and maybe we keep export controls on NVIDIA chips and things like that, and they stop buying Boeing airplanes. But on the smaller items, the stuff that makes up the majority of the 400 and something billion dollars worth of stuff that we import from them, most of that stuff, tariffs go back down to where they were at the start of the year.
And without that walk back, it's much more of a serious downturn.
Correct.
All right. Do you want to do the surprises? Scenario three?
No, you didn't tell me your base case. We talked about mine.
I feel like I did. I sort of walked through.
Yours is the somewhat more pessimistic version of my base case. There's not enough of a walk back. We end up in a deeper recession than I'm anticipating. Is that right?
Just to put it on the table, the few other possible worst case scenarios are that China has been preparing for this for 8 years, and they are clever about how they negotiate. So they prevent the world from aligning with the US because they keep making Trump look bad. And a lot of the world, like Europe, isn't feeling very friendly to Trump after the Ukraine policy. And so it's sort of an everyone loses scenario where Trump can't really make a deal with China or really any material deal with the whole world. I mean, there's some negotiations with Japan and India, but more or less can't even get there with Europe. And then you can get worse from there. It seems like some chance of China doing something provocative around Taiwan, blockading Taiwan. I also think Ukraine could become a proxy war between China and the United States, where you see China wanting to put pressure on Europe by supporting Russia more. If you align against us, we're going to help Russia more or help Russia less.
I left myself my little crawl out space if the walk back is not as big as I'd thought. But everything you said is true. What I will say is that my base case is effectively what I think the market is currently pricing in. There's been a sell-off in U.S. stocks. It's been significant. And I'm not expecting it to get way, way worse. Basically, the dollar is where it is, reflecting the state of the world, but not expecting the capital flight to continue indefinitely, or it would have been worse to this point. We've done ourselves a huge disservice. We've punched ourselves in the face. We get a recession. It's bad, but it's not the kind of trenchant, awful, years-long slog that you just described. It's a little bit less pronounced. So there you go. But yeah, let's do surprises.
Okay.
So the surprise is that effectively, the astonishing advances in artificial intelligence, biotech, other extraordinary new technologies reverse the capital flight and leads to a totally unexpected investment boom in the country, precisely because the productivity growth and the gains are so astonishing that it offsets all of the stupidity of the last few weeks. The idea for this surprise scenario came from Nouriel Roubini, who's Dr. Doom, and yet posted an interesting long tweet the other day where he said, look, the reason that the dollar's not going to lose its status, the reason that the capital flight won't last, is that all of the industries of the future are effectively sourced or originated, or at least have a big presence in the U.S., and everybody's going to want in on that. So all the stuff that you think is going to happen based on the recent trade war is going to be washed off the map by the sudden, unexpectedly fast emergence and implementation of these amazing technologies. So don't worry about it. I say surprising source because Roubini is known for being the most pessimistic person on the planet. He's written books about his pessimism. He was labeled Dr. Doom before the crisis. I saw this and I was like, what is going on here? That's a great surprise scenario.
I saw that too. I think he's right. I think he's not right for a year. I think it's going to take a little longer. So it's probably, again, 18 to 24 months from now. And the next 18 months, or at least the next 6 to 12 months, are mostly dictated by government policy. So my surprise was that somehow there's detente between China and the United States. Trump negotiates a deal on Taiwan with Xi Jinping, and they agree to a 50 to 100-year ground lease on Taiwan. So there's sort of a Hong Kong-Macau deal where we'll give you Taiwan 100 years from now, 50 years from now, taking this concern off the table for the world. Xi Jinping looks like a victor because for China, 100 years is tomorrow. For America, it's forever. That would be my surprise.
Wow. Trespassing all over the realm of diplomacy, international relations, geopolitics, and a little bit of economics in there. I love it. There's flames shooting out of my ears right now. The hot takes are coming fast and furious now from Nouriel. Now a 50-year solution to this. I'd love that. I mean, send that up the chain and see if it happens. A total peaceful solution to this that also involves the reestablishment of global commerce, I think would be amazing for the U.S. economy and for American businesses and workers. So I'm all in on that. It's been an extraordinary few weeks. So I'm really glad we had this chat, Ben. Any final thoughts for listeners? Anything you want to leave them with?
I think AI is going to be so revolutionary, as tough as the next 6 months are probably going to be. I'm optimistic that we'll land the plane. It'll work out. U.S. technology will drive the next bull run.
I hope so. That surprise scenario is sort of half of what would satisfy my deepest wishes, which is just an incredible productivity spurt combined with some wise macroeconomic policy when it comes to trade, immigration, globalization generally, et cetera. I think that would be amazing. So we'll end on that perhaps unjustifiably hopeful note. How about that?
Onward.
Onward indeed. And you've been listening to Onward, the Fundrise podcast, featuring Ben Miller, CEO of Fundrise. I'm Cardiff Garcia of the Economic Innovation Group and host of The New Bazaar. We invite you again to please send your comments and questions to onward@fundrise.com. And if you like what you heard, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and be sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. Finally, for more information on Fundrise-sponsored investment products, including relevant legal disclaimers, check out our show notes. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next episode.